You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is Friday, so it's time for our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders. Brunch with Bernie. Senator?
Tom, how are you?
I'm great. I understand you're on the road.
I am in Rutland, Vermont, and we have had just a great day. We had Secretary of Energy, Moniz, was with the Vermont delegation today, and the governor was with us earlier. And we took him to a community in Rutland where really fantastic things are happening in terms of energy efficiency.
That's great.
We went to a home, Tom, where as a result of weatherization, as a result of solar power, as a result of LED light bulbs, as a result of heat pumps, all of which were put in within a couple of weeks, this household is going to see about a $1,400 a year reduction in their energy bill.
Wow.
And they will use that money to pay back the loan that they got to make these changes. So it's not going to cost them a nickel.
Wow.
And over a period of years after they pay back that loan, then they enjoy the savings. So they're going to create a much more comfortable house, save a whole lot of money, and it doesn't end up costing them a penny. And what we try to convince the secretary about is we think this is exactly what should be done all over the United States of America.
Well, you know, last week there was a day where Germany produced 74% of their electricity because for 10 years they had a program just like that for rooftop solar, a 10-year lease, and you pay it back by the power company buying the electricity back from you.
That's right. That's the most important point about energy, whether it's weatherization and energy efficiency or whether it's sustainable energy. Often the issue is that people need the upfront money to make the changes. But if you can, here in Rutland County also, we have a program where about 1,000 homes are being weatherized. On average, there will be about a 32% reduction in fuel, 32%. And the payback will vary depending on the house, but it could be 4, 5, 6 years. So by getting the upfront money, doing the weatherization, lowering your fuel bill, you pay back the loan, and then you enjoy the savings. But what we also do when we do that is we cut greenhouse gas emissions, and we also create jobs. So this idea of energy efficiency and weatherization is something that is working in Vermont. It's something that has to be expanded in Vermont. We have to do it all over the country.
The proverbial idea whose time has come. What else is going on in the country today that you'd like? That's on your
well, mind? I'm chairman of the Veterans Committee, and we had a 4-hour hearing yesterday. We had Secretary Eric Shinseki before us and others. Let me just say a few words about the VA. Number one, the VA is the largest integrated healthcare system in the country. It's a huge system. And it takes care of about 6.5 million veterans every single year and over 200,000 every day. Can you imagine that?
That's incredible.
It is. With 151 medical centers and 900 primary healthcare facilities, et cetera, et cetera. In general, what the veterans organizations told us yesterday is that once people get into the system, the quality of care is quite good, and there are surveys out there which suggest that in many ways VA healthcare is as good or better than private medical systems. The problem they're having is access. The problem they're having is confusion over waiting lists, and this is an issue that we are addressing right now. The goal has got to be that when people come into the system, they can get health care in a reasonable period of time and enjoy the good quality health care which the system is providing. So we are going to continue working to make sure that VA health care remains strong. We continue to work on comprehensive legislation that would impact positively the lives of millions and millions of veterans. I introduced legislation a couple of months ago. We got 56 votes. I need 60 votes, and we're working to get the remaining four, and I think I'll be bringing that bill up again. But as Memorial Day comes, I think we all want to remember the kinds of sacrifices that veterans and their families have made for this country and to make sure that they get the health care and the benefits to which they are entitled.
Yeah, absolutely.
We are Also this week, I'm sure an issue that you have been discussing is the issue of net neutrality.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
If people want to go to my website, what they can do is what we have done is given people an opportunity to write. And this blows me away, Tom. If my memory is correct, we have over 17,000 people who have written messages, which we are then sending on to the FCC. I beg your pardon, it's over 19,000. Can you imagine that?
Wow. And that's just via one senator's website.
Yeah. These are 19,000 people who are writing opinions, giving views on net neutrality. And what we are doing is then sending those views right to the FCC. And I must imagine that they must, if we have provided 19,000, I can't help think they must have hundreds of thousands of people. And most people understand that the net is a huge instrument for democracy in a time when, in many ways, our country is becoming less and less democratic. So the net is there, and whether you're rich or poor, you are able to receive and send out stuff at the same speed. We don't want to see a situation where big companies are paying large amounts of money so that they can get faster service, and little guys get slower service. From an economic point of view, it is unfair. Walmart should not have an advantage over a small company. New York Times should not have an advantage over a small blog. So we are going to work very, very hard. It's an issue I feel very, very strongly about, and we will play an active role in making sure that we maintain net neutrality. Another issue that we dealt with this week, which will be coming up, I think, on the floor of the Senate fairly soon, has to deal with a really significant crisis in this country. And you hear it in Vermont, you hear it all over America. And that is, number one, the high cost of a college education. And secondly, the indebtedness that people have when they leave school or leave graduate school. So we held a press conference in Burlington on Monday, and I had with me about five or six students. And one young woman is a physician. She practices at a community health center. She went to college. She went to medical school. Do you know what her debt load is now? Take a guess, Tom.
If she went to medical school, it's probably over 100 grand.
Oh, over 100 grand? Try over 300,000.
Wow.
And, you know, that's on the very high end. But it's not uncommon to talk to doctors, dentists, people who went to dental school, medical school, who are over $200,000 in debt. Average debt for a four-year college graduate is, I believe, $29,000, somewhere around there. And that's average. So many have higher debt. The result of all of that is, number one, there are a lot of young people who are bright, who should be going to college, who want to go to college, who are looking at this, and they're saying, you know what? Do I really want to leave school $50,000 or $60,000 of debt? So they're not going to college. And we lose their intellectual capabilities as we have to compete in a global economy, in a very competitive economy. That means if people are not getting the education that they should because they can't afford it, it makes us less economically competitive, and school here in the United States is much higher than any place else in the world. And second of all, when people come out of school deeply in debt, it impacts their choice of jobs. They will go to that job not that they wanted to do, that they had their heart set on doing, but they'll go to that job that pays them the most money so they can repay their debt. So this is a very serious issue. College indebtedness now is more than credit card debt, and it's more than auto debt.
Wow.
And it is an issue that we have to address.
That's just so wrong. It's our intellectual infrastructure.
Exactly.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, our national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders. He'll be taking your calls right after the break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you can check out Bernie's website. Of course, he has a Facebook page and also sanders.senate.gov. And welcome back. Rafiq in Humble, Texas, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes. Good afternoon, Senator.
Good afternoon.
First, I'd like to commend you and Tom for doing a great job because you got someone like me to come out of the shadows and hopefully become a become of some assistance to the Democratic Party. And I have a question regarding the lack of savvy, or at least what I feel, with the Democratic Party, because it doesn't seem that they capitalize on the opportunities, especially with the young voters, as compared to the smear campaign being done by the Republicans.
Well, first of all, thanks for the call. And if Tom and I have played a role in getting you politically involved, I think we're both pretty proud of that. Is that right, Tom?
Amen.
Because what we need in this country is to wake people up to the realization that increasingly, and you've heard me say this many times, we are moving away from a democracy to an oligarchy where the billionaire class, people with endless supplies of money, will control the economic and political life of this country. And the only antidote that I know to that is that millions and millions of people, especially young people and working people, get involved in the political process. So if Rafiq is now getting involved, I think that's great. I would respond in two ways to the comment. Number one, I think there is truth to that. And that is that while there are some absolutely great Democratic representatives and members of the Senate, and I work with them every day, and these folks, men and women, work really hard and they are right on the issues, you have many others who are also impacted by big money and in some cases whose views are not radically different from Republicans. So that's the first issue. The second issue is, and Tom and I have talked about this often, it is not that people are not talking about issues. It is that the media is not necessarily reporting what people are talking about. And it is harder than you think to get progressive views out and to talk about progressive ideas in the media as it's constituted right now. About 95% or more of talk radio is right-wing or extreme right-wing, and they have their agenda, and they push it very, very hard. And there are issues that they will talk about, and there are issues that they simply will not talk about. The fact that we have more wealth and income inequality in this country than any other country on earth and worse than any time since the 1920s, you're not going to hear that much on national TV. And the fact that we have a trade policy which has cost us millions of decent-paying jobs, because companies have outsourced and moved to China, is not something you're going to hear a whole lot about. The fact that you have one out of four corporations in America not paying a nickel in taxes, including companies like General Electric in the last 5 years paying a nickel in federal income taxes, it's not something you're going to hear about. So some of the important issues that some of us raise where we talk about what goes on in America, just it's not something that the corporate media is all that interested in reporting. But having said that, there's no question in my mind that the Democrats can and should do much better.
We'll be back with more of Senator Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie Hour, more of Senator Sanders answering your questions right here on our National Town Hall meeting. Be sure to check out his website at sanders.senate.gov and, of course, over on Facebook. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting with a guy I think of as America's senator, Senator Sanders, and Charles in Opa-locka, Florida, listening on Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn radio app. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Great.
Okay, great. My thing is really the stock market. Yesterday, I heard that the Dow was down a couple points, because they got bad news from companies that we would lose, and that I guess sales were as they were projected, and especially with Walmart. The thing I need to say about that is, don't forget we cut the food stamps. And no matter what, no matter what these big corporations are saying, let's not forget that they also do benefit by using these subsidies given, to our citizens, just, using food stamps. But my question, Senator Sanders, is this. How is dollar stores, Sammy dollar stores, growing at a rapid rate is going to benefit and drive this our superpower economy? And the thing is, the reason why these stores are taking over, you see the Sears and these Kmart stores and Dallas, people don't have enough money in their paychecks. You know, that's what we're asking for. We're asking that you can raise the minimum wage because, you know, we can't build a superpower economy on family dollar stores. It wasn't done so in the past, and we're not going to do it now in the 21st century.
Charles, thank you very much. I think Charles said it better than I can, but I think he hit the nail right on the head. Here's what's going on in the economy. Stores that cater to middle-class Americans, like Sears, I think JCPenney's, and others, are struggling. And the reason that they're struggling and the reason that they're closing down stores is that the middle class just does not have the money to kind of buy the goods that they used to buy. The main point that Charles is making, which is an absolutely correct point, is that about 70% of gross domestic product is dependent upon consumer spending. And if consumers, i.e. the middle class and working families and low-income people, don't have any income, they're not spending any money, and they're not helping to create or sustain jobs. In other words, my spending is your job. Paul Krugman wrote that for the New York Times in an article a few weeks ago. And I think, Tom, in one sentence, that pretty much expresses it.
It really does. Demand drives economy.
My spending is your job. Tom Hartman gets advertising revenue that keeps him going. But if people are not buying the products that are advertised on his show, he loses his job. And that's the way it goes. If you don't have enough money to walk into a restaurant, then the restaurant shuts down. Or you don't have enough money to buy a new pair of shoes, and the shoe store shuts down. And that is called demand-side spending. And what is happening in America, as more and more people leave the middle class and go to the ranks of the poor, as the safety net is cut in terms of food stamps, as Charles mentioned, or extended unemployment. Right now, you have people who are long-term unemployed who are not getting, as used to be the case, because we couldn't get any Republican support for it, they are not getting unemployment checks. Well, if they don't have that unemployment check to spend in their community, less revenue is flowing in that community, fewer jobs. So the point that Charles is making, if I can extrapolate, is that we need to put money into the hands of working people who desperately need it right now. We need to do it by raising the minimum wage, absolutely. We need to do that by developing a strong jobs program which creates millions of jobs, and one way we do that is by rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, that's roads, bridges, rail system, water systems, wastewater plants, create millions of jobs doing that. And that is the way you get the economy moving. You do not, in my view, get the economy moving by trickle-down economics, by giving tax breaks to billionaires. I think it's a false ideology. I think it hasn't worked. I think the only result of that approach is to make the very, very wealthy even wealthier.
Pat in Dixon, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes. My question, hi, both of you. I love both of you. My question is, you know, we pay or, you know, subsidize Walmart and McDonald's and all these people for food stamps and everything. Why doesn't the government, the federal or state government, send a bill to these, like Walmart or McDonald's or something, to get this money back?
Well, Pat, that's a great question, and I hope everybody understands what that question is about. What Pat is saying is, isn't it a little bit crazy that the taxpayers of this country, middle-class, working-class people, have to pay taxes in order to provide food stamps or Medicaid or affordable housing for working people who are employed in jobs that pay them inadequate wages? So you have Walmart, which is a beautiful example, because Walmart is owned by the wealthiest family in the country. It's called the Walton family. They are worth approximately $140 billion. Does it really make sense that somebody who's listening to this show, who's earning $40,000 a year or $30,000 a year, is paying taxes to subsidize the wealthiest family in the country? And the answer is, of course, it makes no sense whatsoever. So what we need to do is to raise the minimum wage to a living wage so that the people who work in Walmart, who work in McDonald's, who work in Burger King, can earn a decent wage. You know, I heard something that was interesting the other day, Tom. I mean, and when they earn that decent wage, then the government does not have to provide them with food stamps or other forms of help. I heard something that was interesting. I don't know if you discussed it on the show. But in, I think it was Denmark, where workers are organized, in McDonald's they were making something like $21 an hour.
There's one of their Walmart or one of their McDonald's workers who, you know, talked about this in the media, and we're trying to book that person for the show right now. Sean is in touch with her, I think it is.
The point being, yeah. In states which have heavy unionization, guess what? Well,
you get
McDonald's
decent.
Can pay a living wage.
Yeah, there you go. We had somebody yesterday, Bernie, called the show and suggested that there be a tax on corporations, that they be denied tax breaks to the extent that their employees use food stamps.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm getting stepped on by my own liners. I'm sorry, Bernie. We'll be right back with Senator Sanders. Sanders.Senate.gov. Check out his website. Tom Hartman here with you, the True People's Media, and it's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our National Town Hall meeting. Bernie, you're still with us?
Right here.
Okay, great. Bill in Nashville, Tennessee, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, yes. Senator Sanders, I've always appreciated your independent point of view and trying to buck the partisan tidal wave that happens down there in Washington, and it doesn't seem to be very functional, but have you ever given any thought to trying a presidential run? That's the only question I had, so I'll just hang up and let you comment in that regard.
Well, as I've discussed on the show and elsewhere, yes. I am giving some thought to that. In fact, I'll be in Iowa tomorrow. But I've got a long way to go before I make a final decision, because running a presidential race is very difficult, it's very expensive, and I have to ascertain whether there is the kind of grassroots support necessary all over this country for the kind of progressive agenda that I would be running on. So, Bill, we are thinking about it, and we're going to do a little bit of traveling and just get a sense of what kind of support there is out there.
Dan in Spokane, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, Senator Sanders. One thing that has always puzzled me, why is it that one person, like Paul Ryan, writes the proposed budget rather than a group of senators and congressmen, which would seem a little more balanced to me, and does everything in his bill become law?
No, Dan. It's called the Ryan budget because he's the chairman of the committee. It doesn't mean that he writes it alone. But what does happen is essentially, not always, but most of the time, the majority party writes the budget. In the case of the House, it is the Republican, it would be the Republican Party. So the Republicans have the majority on all committees, Democrats in the House, Democrats are the majority on all committees in the Senate. And Ryan himself heavily influences the budget. It's not totally his, but it's heavily his. The Ryan budget, which to my mind was a disastrous budget, which gives more tax breaks to the rich, spends more money on the military, ends Medicare as we know it, makes massive cuts in Medicaid and many other very important programs for working people. That is a disastrous budget. It did pass the House, but it's going to go nowhere in a hurry because it would never pass the Senate. So, it is a budget, though, I think, which tells you the priorities of the Republican Party, which is to continue their war against working people while giving more tax breaks to the wealthy and large corporations.
Wayne in Granby, Mass., neck of the woods where Senator Sanders and I were last weekend, listening on WHMP. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, guys, and it was a thrill seeing both of you last weekend.
Oh, great. Thank you.
My question is, I guess, kind of rhetorical. I mean, we hear all the talk about global warming, and yes, the vast majority of scientists, people in the know that it's happening. Where in the world are the people on the right getting their air and water from? Some different source that we don't have that makes it clean? I mean, this is a silly question, I suppose, but what in the world do they think they're going to be breathing in 50 years or drinking in 50 years?
That was my question. A good question, I think, and it's a really troubling question, and I'll tell you why. You know, honest people have honest differences of opinion. You have a lot of honest conservatives there who, you know, don't like Medicare, or they don't like Social Security, or they want to cut federal aid to education and so forth and so on. People have differences of opinion. But what does bother me very much is when you have virtually an entire political party, i.e. the Republican Party, which is now rejecting science. They're rejecting science. So this, you know, when we talk about climate change and global warming, it's not Tom Hartman talking about it. It's not Bernie Sanders talking about it. It is the overwhelming majority of scientists, not only in the United States, but throughout the world, who are saying that climate change is real. It is caused significantly by human activity. It is already causing devastating problems. And what we're seeing every day in the papers now, and reports and studies are coming out, it's only going to get worse and much worse in years to come. That's not politics. That's science. And what amazes me is you have Republicans. I don't see them attacking research in cancer. I don't see them attacking research in heart disease. I don't see them attacking research in other areas of science. Why are they going after climate change science? And I will tell you what I think the answer is. I think the answer is that the big energy companies and folks like the Koch brothers, who make most of their money in fossil fuel, are determined to do everything that they can to prevent us from moving away from fossil fuel, from coal, from oil, from gas, and into sustainable energy, into energy efficiency. And they are prepared to spend huge sums of money supporting candidates who hold that view. And I think that is one reason why you have an entire party heavily dependent upon the Koch brothers and others for their funding that choose to reject the science of climate change.
Lindsay in Highland, Indiana. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. I have a question. I think everyone always talks about free college, and I think that's really great, and I think it should be that way. But a really basic thing that's never touched on, and I think education on the topic is important for people to understand, is how is it paid for then? You know, the overhead, the salaries, keeping the lights on.
Okay.
How is that addressed?
Okay, good question, Lindsay. Here's what happens. You know, 120, 130 years ago in the United States, most working class children did not go to school. They didn't go to high school. People worked on farms. People worked in factories. People worked in fields. But what happened 120, 150 years ago in America is only the wealthy went to school. They went to private academies. They went to college. And then what happened, there was an evolution. And working class families said, you know what, I want my kid to do better than I have. And I want my kid to get a good education. And out of that came the concept of public education. And what public education in all of the states said, it varied state by state, but what it said is, look, education should be a right, R-I-G-H-T, of all children regardless of income. And so public schools were established. And that was true 100 years ago. It's true today that when a kid walks into a public school, nobody says, well, you can't come in because you know, you got to pay $50 to get into school today. It is free. Now, is it free? Is it not paid for? Of course it's paid for. It's paid for out of the tax base. In our country, it's paid through significantly local taxes, often property taxes. It's paid sometimes by county taxes, certainly by state taxes, and often by federal taxes. But it's paid by taxes. Now, what other countries have said is, well, it's great that people can go to free high school, free elementary school, but in this day and age, we should make college also free for the individual because we need to have, in Scandinavia, in France, in Germany, we need to have the best educated workforce possible. And we think it's dumb for our country that you have bright kids who have a lot to contribute to the economy not being able to get an education. So we're going to provide that education for them. And by the way, it wasn't just European countries or Scandinavian countries. In America in the 1950s, 1960s. Do you know how much the University of California cost?
Zero.
Do you remember how much?
Oh, I hitchhiked out there to visit a bunch of friends of mine from Michigan who moved out there to go to college for free.
For free. So this is not, you know, this is not when I was talking about, you know, Denmark or Sweden. We're talking about the United States of America in the 50s and the 60s. And our country at that point, not our country, certain states, California did, New York City did, Vermont State colleges were either free or very inexpensive. I think it was true all over the country.
Yeah.
But then what happened, because of economic problems, states had to cut back. They said, well, we're not going to provide free education. You're going to have to pay a little in tuition. Every year it went up and up. And now you're in the absurd situation where to go to where the best schools in America cost $50,000 or $60,000 a year. And people are coming out of school hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. So to answer your question, Lindsay, of course it's not free. Nothing is free. But we have to make a decision as a country as to whether or not we want the best educated nation in the world. We used to be that. We used to have more people, higher percentage of people graduating college in the United States any other country on earth. Today we're in about 12th place, and that is not a good position to be in. So I do believe that we have to move in that direction. You're not going to have that overnight. And in fact, I'll be introducing legislation that moves us in that direction. But what we also have to do now is get a handle on student loans. Interest rates all over this country are much, much too high. There'll be legislation on the floor, which will give people the right to refinance their loans at significantly lower rates than they're paying right now. So a big issue. It's a big issue. We start small by lowering student loans. We move bigger by saying, yes, in America, regardless of your income, you should be able to get a college education.
Yeah. We just have about 30 seconds. I saw an interesting statistic the other day, Senator. In before Ronald Reagan's presidency and for decades, maybe a century before that, about 80% of the total cost of colleges in the United States was paid for by state, local, federal governments or college endowments. 20% was tuition. Now, 33 years later, it has completely reversed. 80% of the costs are paid for by tuition. 20% is endowments. And
if I'm not mistaken, Tom, in terms of that statistic, we demand far more from the individual than any other country on earth.
Yes. Yeah, any other developed country.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're there with, I don't know, Namibia or something. It's just incredible. Senator Sanders is with us, Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, our national town hall meeting. Senator Sanders answering your questions. Be sure to check out his websites. They've got a Facebook page. And also, of course, Sanders.Senate.gov.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
That was Sanders.Senate.gov. And you can find Bernie's Facebook page quite easily. And welcome back. Brenda, watching Free Speech TV in Golden, Colorado. You are on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes, I would like to know how the progressives can be better organized. I want to support progressives. I'm interested in what Lawrence Lessig did last week, but there's too many small groups. Where should I put my money? I only have a little to give.
Well, that's a hard question, Brenda. How do progressives become better organized? Well, I think for a start, start looking around your community. Find people who share your perspectives, and start reaching out to more and more people. And I think at the end of the day, we have to do it community by community by community. The one point that I would make, Brenda, and it's not a good answer to your question, is that I want you to know that what we believe, which is that we have to do something about this terrible income and wealth inequality, that every American is entitled to health care as a right, that climate change is wrong, and that we've got to address the need to reduce carbon emissions, that we have to make college affordable. All of those issues, those are issues not just that quote-unquote progressives believe in. Those are issues that the vast majority of the American people believe in. So what we have got to do in a way that we have not done before is just reach out and educate and organize. I don't know what community you're in, but I will guarantee you there are like-minded people there. And you've got to figure out how you get organizations started and how you get people involved politically. As I mentioned earlier, in the coming election, we estimate that 60% of the American people will not vote. In some states, that number is even higher than that. And among low-income and working people, the number is much higher. We're talking about 70-80% of low-income people not voting in an election, and they have the most at stake. How do we bring those people into the political process? That's the challenge. We're going to have to do it community by community by community.
Arthur in Cons Malden, Mass. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hi, it's Malden, Massachusetts.
Oh, Malden.
It's near, near Boston.
Okay.
As you know, Senator Sanders, I'm grateful, and also to you, Mr. Hartman. And as you know, the U.S. veterans who have low or no income are eligible for subsidized health care through the VA. I'm an Army veteran with 9 years of service, having spent years in Iraq and Germany. And when I came home in 2005 to Orlando, Florida, I decided to go to college rather than find a job. I had no income. While living in Orlando, I visited the VA clinic there, but nobody there made me aware that people with low or no income are eligible for subsidized health care through the VA. Now, since then, I found out. I moved to Massachusetts, you know, which is why I'm calling from Boston area, and the VA Boston informed me that I was eligible for free medical care, which I have now been accessing. A few months ago, I got a letter from the VA stating that eligibility is now redirected to Social Security, which means if I get Social Security, I'm automatically eligible. They already, you know, so I don't have to fill out those applications anymore. I was just wondering how this might change the way that U.S. military war veterans find out how they could be eligible for free health care.
Arthur, thank you very much. I mean, what you are addressing is an issue that I've been trying to do some work on.
Let's pick this up on the other side of the break, Bernie. We'll restate the question real quickly. So we'll be right back with Senator Sanders. Arthur, thank you for the call. I'm sorry I missed the time cue on that. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Brunch with Bernie Hour, and Bernie, a veteran just called with a question about how do veterans find out about eligibility, particularly low-income veterans.
That is an issue as chairman of the Veterans Committee that I've been working hard on, and that is we need to do better outreach. The VA needs to do better outreach to make sure that every veteran in this country knows what he or she is entitled to. There has been some improvement in recent years. Their website is a lot better than it used to be. Still have a long way to go. The problem is that VA eligibility over the years has changed significantly. During the Clinton years, for example, as I recall, Clinton virtually opened up the VA to almost any veteran. Many, many veterans came in. The system got swamped. There were waiting lines that were too long. Under Bush, they closed it down. In my view, and we have legislation that would do it, we would open it up again, making sure that we have adequate staffing. But the problem is those numbers, eligibility changes over the years, and it's kind of a complicated formula. But what I would suggest, Arthur, is, for a start, people who have questions about whether they are eligible for VA health care, and Arthur is absolutely right, certainly those people have service-connected problems. So you were injured as part of the U.S. military, hurt in war. You are certainly eligible for VA health care, but low-income veterans also are eligible. To find out about eligibility for a start, go to the VA website, or you can call up the VA.
David in Chicago, listening to WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. David?
Oh, hi.
Hey.
Sorry about that. You cut out there in the beginning of it. Couldn't you read it? Yeah, I had a question about the minimum wage thing you're trying to put through. Now, we know that Walmart and many of them are most likely, when you get the $15 an hour, what they'll end up doing is just giving people only 2 days a week, which is going to put them right where they are now anyway. So I was wondering if in that legislation you could put in something along the lines of $15 an hour or, say, $31,000 a year, whichever is greater, and therefore, keeping it where we want it to be.
Minimum salary as well as a minimum wage.
Yes.
Well, that's a good question. I'm not quite sure how one can do that. I think all I can say right now is that the immediate task in front of us, and $15 is very ambitious. Seattle, and I take my hat off to them, I believe will pass a $15 an hour minimum wage, but that is not going to go into effect until a couple of years. It will gradually go up. Vermont just passed a minimum wage increase as well, which will take us over 10-10. And I hear David's legitimate concern, but it is not necessarily so easy, David, for companies to run everybody on part-time. But I think the goal right now that we have to focus on is to raise the minimum wage. We got a $10.10 bill on the floor of the Senate. We are going to keep fighting for that. The national minimum wage is 7.25, which is a starvation wage. 10 would be a step forward, and then we go further than that. Right now where we are is we have virtually no Republican support, but I think pressure is beginning to build. Mitt Romney, of all people, came out and said, well, yeah, I think we should raise the minimum wage. Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota came out and said that. Rick Santorum came out recently and said that. So these are conservative Republicans who understand that the optics of Republicans not willing to raise what amounts to a starvation wage at 7.25 looks pretty bad for them. So I think at the end of the day, we are going to win it, but it is certainly at this point not going to be anywhere near $15 an hour.
Cindy in Euclid, Ohio. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Great honor to speak to both you gentlemen. Senator Sanders, I have a question about the charter schools. If they might, down the line, lead to some kind of redistricting and solidifying of power to the wealthy districts, gerrymandering and so forth.
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand that question. I don't know that charter schools have much to do with gerrymandering.
I think Cindy, maybe because you vote in your local public school, is confusing school districts with voting districts.
Yeah, I don't think so, Cindy. I mean, there's a lot of debate about the wisdom or lack of wisdom of charter schools. There's a heck of a lot of discussion about gerrymandering. And gerrymandering is I think most listeners know, every 10 years, legislatures are able to change legislative districts. And, you know, theoretically, a district is supposed to be made up of contiguous communities. But what Republicans have, it's always been done, but what Republicans have taken to a new level is carving out these very, very weirdly shaped districts to make sure that politically they are able to maximize the vote by doing that. So they figure out ways that they gain additional seats for their legislatures or their houses of representatives. And that is a very, very serious issue, which I think we have to deal with both legally and legislatively.
Senator, we have a minute and a half left. It's really not enough to get a caller in. Your thoughts for the end of the week?
Well, my thoughts for the end of the week is that I want to go back to a point that we talked about a moment ago. The pundits tell us, Tom, that in the coming election, about 60% of the American people are not going to vote. Younger people, the number is higher. Lower-income people, the number is higher. So you're talking about maybe 70, 80% of low-income people and younger people not participating. Meanwhile, on the other hand, we hear that the billionaire family, the Koch brothers and others, are prepared to spend hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. So you add those two facts together, that billionaires are going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars supporting candidates who want to cut food stamps, cut Medicaid, cut federal aid to education, deny the reality of climate change, and then you have young people and working people not voting. That is a very, very dangerous dynamic, a very dangerous dynamic. That means big money dominates what happens and working people have no say in what happens. So my message is that people have got to understand that what happens in Washington is of enormous consequence. And we've got to get involved politically. We've got to make sure that our family and our friends come out and vote. We've got to fight for the best candidates that we can find.
Senator, thanks so much for everything you do, and especially for coming on this program. Thank you.
Tom, thank you. Take care.
Great talking. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday right after this.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. It's Anything Goes Friday. You pick the topic and we'll talk about it. I've seen this very interesting little piece over on Democratic Underground. Apparently, Twitter redesigned their site so that your description thing has to be smaller than it did used to be or something like that. And if you go to the GOP Twitter site, it used to say... You know, it used to have a logo in the middle and some stock photos, and it used to say something like, create your American dream. But the CR got cut off, and so now, and the E, and so now it says, RNC, ate your American dream. No, I'm not making this up. I mean, it may not be true over on Twitter. I'm assuming it is, though. It's on DU. This is hysterical. They've changed it by now? Yeah, okay. Shane says they've already fixed it. Yeah. I mean, they got enough money. You'd think that, you know, as soon as DU calls them out on it, you know, they'd be all over it. Anyhow, Raymond, listening on KBCS in Roy, Washington. Hey,
Washington.
Raymond, what's up?
Hey, that's funny. They ate my dream. Yeah, well, as a veteran, I'm currently trying to get my benefits up because I lost my job because of my disability. But in talking to a lawyer, it appears that the VA has adopted the Social Security.
Whoa! I just dropped him. I'm sorry. We've got this new set, new organization, and everything is in different places. And I just set my hand down on the table, and it hit the mouse, and boom! I just dropped that caller, and I forgot your name. I'm sorry, but please call right back. I think we have an open line, and if we don't, call back shortly. I will put you back on. I'm totally my fault. And what I did was I moved it to the next caller, which is Ashes in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Ashes, you are on the air now.
All right, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, I will do my best not to dump you.
My question was, do you know when Senator Sanders ran for the House and Senate, like, on average, how many times would he debate his opponents in those races?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I lived in Vermont for a couple of his House, you know, he ran every 2 years for the House, for a couple of his House runs, and I think... By the time we had left Vermont, he was already in the Senate. I could be wrong, but I don't remember him ever engaging in any debates with anybody. But that may just be because we didn't own a television when we lived in Vermont, and so I wasn't paying attention. I don't know.
I asked this because in my district, every 2 years when there's a House race, my House rep and his opponent or her opponent, I don't remember there ever being a debate between them.
Yeah.
Or ever being, if there was a debate, it was publicized so the public can know there
yeah.
are debates.
Yeah, they try to avoid that and kind of thing these days more and more.
That's where I get most of my information from is when they debate.
Yeah.
And I don't pay attention to the commercials at all. So
this, you know, back during the... you may not be old enough to remember the Nixon-Kennedy debates. It was 1960. I mean, I was just a little kid then. I was 9 years old. But it was the networks ran that for free without commercials. And I don't know if they did so because they were required to, if they did so as their way of complying with the Fairness Doctrine and helping their affiliates, or if they just did it because it was the right and patriotic thing to do. But I think that local stations, we should have some sort of an organized system where if they're not compelled to do it, maybe they're incentivized to do it by, you know, some kind of a tax break or something that that would pretty much put any member of the House or Senate who's, you know, a major serious candidate. You don't want to get a situation like this one that went viral the other day on the internet where you had the biker and the guy who was, you know, shouting about Jesus yelling at each other. But I mean, it was hysterically funny, but, it wasn't a particularly informative debate. But and in fact, I would like to include the secondary parties. I think it's really important to get the Green Party, the Libertarian Party, the Progressive Party in Vermont, some of these, you know, secondary, tertiary parties in, maybe not the biker party, but, you know, not to diss bikers. They just happen to have one particular crazy guy. But to have debates, I'm really with you on that, Ashes, because that typically is an incredible source of information. And now we pretty much only do it at the presidential level. So, yeah, thanks for the call. I'm sorry I didn't, you know, Bernie takes sometimes a long time to answer a question. And we had a lot of people on hold asking questions for him, and we didn't get to your call for him. I'm sorry. Try again next week. We'll have to ask Bernie. Jim in Minneapolis, listening on KTNF. Hey, Jim, what's up? Jim, you are on the air. Jim, you are listening to your phone, listening to your radio, not your phone. Laura in Thompsonville, Illinois. Hey, Laura, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi.
Hi.
You do a great job.
Thank you.
Getting the message out.
Thank you. So what's on your mind?
I had a question for Bernie, but I didn't get to it. So I'll ask you.
Okay. I'll do my best.
Now, here in Illinois Medicaid picks and chooses what medications to cover.
Mm-hmm.
And first they decided not to cover antipsychotics for 6 weeks. They added that back in because the psychiatric institutions were filling up. And now they've decided not to cover controlled substances like Ativan for psychiatric use.
I don't know what Ativan
is. And I was
wondering
why they would do that.
You said controlled substances. I mean, technically all prescription drugs are controlled substances. Is Ativan a narcotic? Is that what you mean?
No, it's for anxiety.
Uh-huh. So it's like a Valium kind of drug or something like that. Sorry, I'm not a pharmacist. I don't know. What I do know is that, you know, the whole thing of Medicaid, when it was rolled out much like Obamacare, actually, post John Roberts Supreme Court decision. It was rolled out as a to the states. The federal government will pick up, I think, about 60% of it. You have to pick up about 40% of it, as I recall. I think it's still about that. And, to cover the poorest people in your state. And so typically just the very, very bottom of the income scale or people with no income at all qualify for Medicaid. And because it was voluntary for the states, there were a lot of states that didn't pick up Medicaid the first couple of years after it rolled out as part of the role. I think it was part of the war on poverty during the LBJ era. But because the states had that independence, they also had independence about how they were going to administer it, how they're going to spend that money, what they were going to cover, what they weren't. And so you get these weird state-to-state variations that persist to this day. The rationale for the state of Illinois, I can guarantee you Bernie wouldn't have known off the top of his head, and I don't either. It would be a good question, though, Laura, for you to contact. I mean, you have two state senators in Illinois, and more importantly, for a question like this, you have a member of the House of Representatives, and I don't know who that is, but if you call the congressional switchboard, it's over at callcongress.org, and just say, here's my zip code, who represents me in the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives people tend to be more responsive to, because they represent a smaller number of people, they have a person on their staff who's called the constituent services person, and they tend to be more responsive to specific questions. They might be able to figure that out for you or answer your question. Does that make sense?
Okay.
It's a good place to start, and you're already paying taxes for it, so, you know, go for it. Laura, thanks for that. And you never know. I mean, even though that's a federal official, you also have a state senator and a state representative wherever, in Illinois, or is it the assembly? Each state calls it something different. But you have one in Illinois. You've got a bicameral legislature. So you've got two elected representatives in Illinois. You might want to call them, too, because they control Medicaid in the state.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you can also call the governor's office. Pat Quinn, I think, is still the governor of Illinois. He's a good guy. I would call his office, too. Make some noise. Ask some questions. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Marie, watching Free Speech TV in Carbondale, Colorado. Hey, Marie, what's up?
Well, I was hoping I could address this to both you and Bernie. Let me preface my question with a couple of comments. I think we're on the cusp of something really wonderful. I think we're about to move into what I call a moral and ethical and spiritual evolutionary period. I'm heartened by the news, for example, of the Stanford students who are pushing the university to divest and deal with climate control. And I'm heartened by the Fight for 15 movement. It just seems like people are waking up all over the world. And I believe in quantum physics. I believe there's a critical mass that we're beginning to begin. We're almost at that point. Now, here's where you and Bernie come in. I'm not aware of a website where I can go as a private citizen or as a community organization to plug into something that's a movement going on all over the country. I'm aware of MoveOn.org. I'm aware of the Occupy movement. I mean, there are lots of different little movements. But I'm wondering if it might be possible for you and Bernie, separate from political parties, to create a website that gives folks ways of taking up your challenge of tag your it.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like you have a national audience. There are a lot of us that are listening to you. And somehow, if we could have a clearinghouse or a place where we could speak to one another across the country and be active, united with each other, but active on specific issues within our communities. There we go.
Yeah. I know that Bernie couldn't do that outside of the state of Vermont because he's only, there's all these laws about being what you can and can't do with federal dollars, and Bernie's not independently wealthy. He's not like, Daryl Issa. He's not worth $700 million. Bernie's just an average guy, has been his whole life. So it's not going to happen there. I mean, sanders.senate.gov and bernie.org. And by the way, if anybody listening is in the neighborhood of Iowa, over at Bernie.org, they've got all the information for where Bernie's going to be tomorrow, and you can go over and see him and hear him, and it's going to be a great thing. With regard to our website, we do have a message board. People can create their own blogs. What we don't do is supervise, like, helping people set up groups in their kitchen or their living room kind of thing. Because there's already groups doing that. There's Democracy for America, Jim Deems' group. There's MoveToAmend.org, which does that. Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, does that. MoveOn.org, I believe, does that. There's at least six or seven groups. The Drinking Liberally people are really good at this. I mean, I would, do some poking around, and maybe a good way to do it would be to show up at a local Democratic Party event and just ask people, what do you do outside of this? And find some people who are, if your passion is inequality, there are inequality subsets within, for example, PDAmerica.org, probably within democracyforamerica.com. Find one, and if there isn't one, Marie, you could start one. So, tag your it. Thank you for the call. Sorry to dump that on you. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Anything Goes Friday. Your calls, my thoughts, the news of the day. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yeah, I was looking at this Iben Pass. I guess that's the pronoun. Correct way to pronounce it, system, where they have a 40 story tower, stationary tower. I've not quite got.
You're talking about the giant solar power thing?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Not the one you were talking about. That's a chemical solar panel, and we'll see how that works.
Right.
But what this thing does is they use a 40-story tower, and it's with the mirrors. Each mirror, they're $6,000 a piece for each of these thousands of mirrors, and they move to keep that tower heated up.
Right.
I can't quite understand why they don't put a array of mirrors stationary, and you could make them out of anything, and then have a radial stacker out of a quarry, a telescoping stacker, and have it follow the focal point of the parabolic curve. The Earth is still rotating, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Okay,
I don't know the. I'm not in my my trig is gone. I don't know because you wouldn't have just it wouldn't be just a straight arc. It would be a parabola, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Set the mirrors up as a parabola and have the focal point be on the outside of the array, and then utilize something that is already designed and already built. In other words, everything would be recycled except for the specific media, like you'd have to use sulfur, which would be a better conductor of heat. And then, of course, with a sulfur storage system, you would have a solar array that would run 24 hours a day, 365 days a year.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to figure out why they keep trying to invent the wheel. You know, we've got one.
Yeah. Well, I don't know the question or the answer to the question. I understand the question, I think. I have to assume, because these are for-profit enterprises that are doing it, these are not state utilities, that they're doing it the least expensive way they can or the most efficient way they can. I mean, you know, that's not always the case with for-profit enterprises, but it typically at the level of production, you know, where they're producing their product, they are relatively efficient. So I just, you know, it's an interesting thought, Steve. Let me give some thought to it. Maybe a solar engineer will call in with some added thoughts on it. But you've opened an interesting door. Thanks for the call. Kevin in Dallas, Oregon. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me. I'm new to the show, so I'm not sure what topics you cover and what you don't.
Anything you want. It's Friday.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for the good news from Tesla and the solar panel field. That's about the best good news I've had come off the TV in a long time.
Good.
But have you ever heard much about geoengineering, climate engineering?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there have been some experiments. There are a bunch of theories. Some of them, I think, are crackpot theories. Some of them, I think, are dangerous. Some of them may have merit, although I can't name any that may. But the last IPCC report said if we don't do something, this may be the last option we have. And that's almost an endorsement. It's pretty spooky.
Well, there's a geoengineeringwatch.org site that people could go to get a lot of great information. I've been following this since 2006, and here in Oregon, we get sprayed on a daily basis. I mean, it's so bad that it actually fogs out the foothills. I live in a small community, you know, right below the mountain ranges and stuff, and it gets so bad that it just fogs it out. And
aren't you just talking about the winds coming off the ocean? I mean, you know, carrying the humidity?
No. If people go to geoengineeringwatch.org, and this, believe me, I've called the EPA. They say they know nothing about it. I called the FAA. They know nothing about it. I called the DEQ. They know nothing about it.
Well, just because it's on the internet doesn't mean it's real, Kevin.
Well, but if I go online, I can find hundreds and hundreds of sites. And anybody who is denying that they're spraying anything is off.
Well, who's the they and what are they spraying and how are they spraying it? Are you talking about the stuff coming out of jet engines?
Well, those are contrails. Those are vapor trails.
Yeah.
Those have nothing to do with what we see.
Okay, who's the they and what are they spraying and why?
Well, you know, that's what I have been calling. I called the EPA. I called these people. They don't even admit that it's even going on. They won't even say anything about it, and they just stovepipe me to different.
I mean, we know that there have been, for example, just before the Olympics in China, the Chinese government was seeding clouds to the east of Beijing with silver iodide crystals, which we've used for, you know, decades to cause clouds.
Been doing that since the 40s.
Yeah, to cause clouds to rain out so that by the time they got to Beijing, it was clear skies. You know, but they were pretty open about that. And you know, it wasn't particularly toxic. And, you know, it might not be the best idea, but I don't know if anybody who's doing anything. You know, there has been a proposal that one way to deal with the decrease in albedo of the Earth because of the melting polar caps is to start putting titanium dioxide into jet fuel so that jet planes are actually leaving behind not just ice crystals, but also a little bit of, you know, white paint basically up there in the sky.
But aluminum and barium is what it is, and it's designed to reflect the heat of the sun away from the
Earth. Yeah, but then there's other people who say, you know, if they try that, there's all kinds of side effects to that, and it alters the chemistry of the atmosphere, and, you know, it's just like, you know, it's not a good idea. Okay. So I don't know.
Yeah. Those are more to be concerned about to me. You know what I mean? I'm not a grandfather. I want to be someday. I really think that this affects people's health. And, and we're going to try to make it, you know, I'm with you. I just don't know who's doing it. That's my question. I want to find out who it is.
Yeah. Well, I'm still wondering if it is. But, you know, between the two of us, maybe we'll find something out. Kevin, thanks a lot for the call. And I'm guessing, you know, you gave out a couple of websites there. I'm guessing some of our listeners and viewers will be tracking them down, and maybe we'll get some feedback. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Back with more of your calls right after this. Talk media for the sane among us, the Tom Hartman Program, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Welcome back. Raymond in Roy, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Raymond, sorry to have dumped you before.
Yeah, drops happen.
I'm glad you called back.
Well, you know, I had to, I'm a disabled veteran. I'm trying to get my disability up because I lost jobs for that. And I was talking to an attorney, and the attorney said, well, they have, it appears that the VA has adopted the Social Security Administration's policy of deny, deny, deny. What that does is it keeps their numbers low, and it makes them look like they're doing really good. And I was wondering, what's your take on that? And I'll go ahead and hang up and listen to you after that.
I don't know, Raymond. I think that I know that both agencies are operating on threadbare budgets that are the consequence of decades of largely Republican austerity. And, you know, so when you're operating an agency and you just really don't have the money to operate the agency, you try to do as much as you can with as little as you have. And if that means, you know, making it harder for people to get access to what you're doing, you know, tragically, that's the predictable consequence.
But, you know, we have to give kudos to the Obama administration for at least trying to do something, although it's not the best.
Oh, yeah. Just 3 months ago, you know, Mitch McConnell led a filibuster a successful filibuster in the Senate. It got 56 votes. Under the Constitution, it passed. There's 100 senators. And if you get more than half, which would be 51 votes, it's supposed to become legislation. But according to the Senate rules, If the Republicans filibuster, then you have to have 60 votes to break that filibuster. Mitch McConnell led a filibuster of a $31 billion bill. Might have been $21 billion. I'm pretty sure it was $31 billion. To increase benefits for veterans and increase funding for the Veterans Administration to deal with these kind of things.
Yeah.
And the Republicans, wouldn't go along with it because Barack Obama would not add to it Keystone XL pipeline for the Koch brothers.
Well, you see, and that underscores that for this midterm, everybody needs to get out and vote.
Yeah.
And that's why your tagline is tag I'm it and let's all do something.
There you go. And not just you, but, you know, bring 10 friends to the polls. I mean, you know, get as many people to the polls as possible. Excellent point, Raymond. Thank you very much for the call. Dave in Mamaroneck, I'm not saying that right, New York State. How you
doing? Just saying it right.
Okay, great. So what's up, Dave?
Hi, I just wanted to make a prediction about how the crash of 2016 will happen.
Okay.
Right, there was an article yesterday in the Wall Street Journal that states aren't collecting as much in taxes because capital gains tax rate, not that the rate has gone down, but the collection is coming down because a lot of people sold their holdings to avoid the 5% increase.
Right.
And what should happen is that all lead to state budget deficits, and that'll lead to people getting laid off.
Yep.
It'll also lead to budget deficits, which will lead to less money getting pumped into the economy.
Right. These austerity programs lead to death spirals, basically. And in this case, you're saying that increasing the capital gains tax for 1 year is, you know, the people sold last year so that they wouldn't have to pay this year if they had a capital gain. I would be surprised if just a change in the capital gains tax of only 5% would be enough to affect that large. I mean, you know, there's some people who have very, very large portfolios and do a lot of, but this, first of all, you'd have to have a huge portfolio for this to have any consequence. And secondly, you'd have to be trading frequently enough that, you know, year to year, it wouldn't matter. I don't see how that could be. I mean, I remember when Reagan dropped the capital gains tax by like 15 or 20%, something like that, in 86. Louise and I sold a business because the capital gains tax had changed or was going to go up. Reagan was actually going to raise it back up again, and it was going to go up. And so we sold the business in the year we did rather than the year after when we really wanted to sell it. Because, you know, it would have saved us a few tens of thousands of dollars. But we still would have sold the business the year later. It's like, you know, these changes are really kind of micro changes within small periods of time. They're not macro changes that have huge effects.
Well, I'm not saying that the government shouldn't increase the capital gains tax. What I'm saying is that the budget deficit going down and the trade deficit going up represents the pump of money going into the economy, and when that switches back, you're going to have the crash. And right now, we have a false sense of security because budget deficits have gone. The Obama administration has decreased the budget deficit
at the federal level,
austerity and capital gains collections.
Right,
but
and an improved economy. I mean, that has had probably more impact than anything else. It's not much improved, but corporate profits are right now at the highest level they've been ever.
95% of that gain went to the 1%.
Right, but they're paying taxes on it.
Really.
And those taxes are being collected, and so that's helping close the budget gap. But I agree with you. Our economy is being held together with bubblegum and bailing wire. It's a house of cards. I mean, I could throw another half a dozen lousy cliches, but we have not undergone the fundamental structural reforms that are necessary to make a strong economy. And until we do, we are going to be living on the edge of a crash. And after that crash, hopefully, we will make those changes. Dave, thanks for the call. Susan in Wauna, Washington. Hey, Susan, what's up? Susan? Susan is not there. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Well, we have photovoltaics, that's light to electricity, thermoelectrics, that's heat to electricity, and piezoelectric, that's pressure to electricity, and none of them require water, and I think that should be the new standard for creating electricity. But I'd like to talk about the possibility, because I don't believe it exists yet, the possibility of harvesting free electrons from both our atmosphere and the world's oceans. And if you Google free electrons in the atmosphere or free electrons in the ocean, it turns out that because the sun's bombardment of the upper atmosphere, it knocks the radiation from the sun, the extreme radiation, knocks off a lot of electrons off of atoms, so you have a lot of these free electrons.
That's why it's called the ionosphere.
Right.
It's filled with ions.
And also, I believe the rotation of the world, it turns out that the Earth is actually rotating faster than the atmosphere, so
there's
a
correct
drag. And I believe this friction also frees up electrons. And
yes,
in the ocean, you have the constant movement of the ocean creating these electrons. And
you know why Ben Franklin flew that kite?
Yeah.
He had invented the Leyden jar, and or if he hadn't invented it, he was using them. I don't recall which it was now. It's been years since I read the biography of him. But the Leyden jar was the world's first capacitor, sort of a battery. It was they take a glass bottle, like a gallon jug, they'd line the inside and the outside with tin foil, and, connect one part, one would be positive and the other negative, basically, and to the electrode that was connected to the inner part, he attached that to a wire and ran that wire up a kite into the air. And the goal was to collect those free electrons that are in the air that accumulate during thunderstorms and to store that in a Leyden jar. And he had some success in doing that, if I recall correctly. This is an idea that's been around since the 1770s.
Well, I looked it up, and it turns out electrons carry a negative charge. And I thought of bar magnet, and a bar, as you say, a bar magnet would have positive on one side and negative on the other. And now with the new quantum.
But hang on, that's magnetism, not electricity. And
I know, but here it is. The positive side of the magnet would be used to attract the negative electron, which would tunnel through the bar magnet. Now, it turns out halfway down the bar magnet, between positive and negative, there's a neutral zone, but the velocity of the electron might be enough to go through the neutral zone to the negative, where it's repulsed, and then that could create inertia to make it run a circuit or store it in a battery. So this would be the magnetic harvesting of free electrons in the atmosphere and in the oceans.
Horst von Heyer, God rest his soul, a dear old friend of mine in Germany who just died a year or so ago in his late 80s, spent several decades of his life trying to create basically a machine that would do that, that would use magnets, moving magnets, and the magnetic field of the Earth to try to produce more electricity, more energy than was put into it. The principle, first of all, the reason a negative electrical charge is a presence of electrons and a positive electrical charge is the absence of electrons, which is totally counterintuitive, is because back before DeForest had come up with a diode, a vacuum tube diode, they had assumed that that's the way it was. It went back to Ben Franklin's day. And it wasn't until they actually started moving electrons through vacuums that they discovered that negative was the excess of electrons, positive was the absence of electrons. But with a magnetic field, you've got what's called north and south. It's not negative and positive, it's north and south. And if you spin a magnetic field in the presence of a piece of wire, or if you spin wire around a magnetic field, then it will induce an electric current in that wire. Some of that magnetic field will produce an excess of electrons, which will move through the wire. The problem is the amount of energy that it takes to spin that magnet is greater than the amount of electricity, the total energy that comes out of it. But this is the principle. This is how generators work. And that's why you hook that spinning magnet inside a bunch of wires, with a bunch of coils of wire, up to like a turbine on a dam. Harvey, good luck.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Yeah, more people are probably familiar with car alternators, but a car alternator is a generator. I mean, it's the exact, except it, you know, it's the exact same thing as Hoover Dam. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour, and Bruce in Richmond, Indiana, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Bruce, what's on your mind?
Tom, how you doing today?
I am great, but I'll get better. Bruce, how about you?
Well, my saying about keeping America together is using duct tape and vice grips.
Yeah. Tragically, that's kind of where we're at.
I know it. Well, I wanted to make a comment about being on disability, because I've been on disability since 08.
Social Security?
Social
SSI.
Security disability. And this is echoing what Raymond was saying earlier about, being denied.
Mm-hmm.
I come down with a neuromuscular disease, and it took me about a year to finally get my disability benefits, because after I saw my neurologist, he put me out of work 10 minutes after seeing him.
Yeah, and my understanding is that a year is actually pretty good. The average is a little under 2 years.
Yeah, it is good. I must have had a good lawyer.
Yeah.
Because you have to get a lawyer now once you're denied.
Right.
Well, I was denied three times, and I finally got my benefits. Yeah. What I wanted to mention was I've been trying to get food stamps for the past, since 2009 when I got my disability.
Mm-hmm.
And I get denied every year because I make too much money on disability. Now, I don't know if you've heard of that or not, but I've been wanting to talk to you about this for about a month now, but I had to spend some time in the hospital. It's a progressive disease, so.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Bruce, I think that's something that you would need to take up with your state officials, because even though food stamps are federal programs, much like Medicaid, they're administered by the states, and different states have different standards for food stamp eligibility. And it may be
I do go on the website for the state and make out applications every year. And every year I get the notice in the mail saying you make too much money.
Well, Mike Pence and his Republican buddies there in Indiana have figured out a way to make sure that you can't have a comfortable lifestyle if you're not working, and even if you're not capable of working, even if you're disabled. And I think that's wrong, but that's their philosophy. They want to motivate you to become a productive member of society, or they want to punish you for not being a productive, or some bizarre thing. I don't know. They just want to keep the taxes low on the billionaires.
They spend more time working against you than they do helping you, because they don't take into consideration that when you're making out the application, they want to ask you all these personal questions about bills and finances and stuff like that. But when they come right down to making their decision, they base it on how much you owe on hospital bills and not how much you pay out as far as, electricity, phone bill, mortgage, stuff like that. They don't take none of that into consideration. Yeah. If they did, I probably would get benefits.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was my Friday rant.
Yeah. Okay. Bruce, thanks for sharing it with us. I'm sorry to hear that Indiana is treating you so poorly. Not entirely surprised. And, sometimes I suppose if you're on disability and you've been in the same place for a while, it doesn't make sense to move to another state where they may have more generous benefits. But it's just wrong. I mean, we're the richest country in the world. And we can't look out for people, to paraphrase Jesus, the least among us, for those in need. Really? The richest country in the world? We can't do this? We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before you. It's Talk Media for the rest of us, the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. And speaking of news, let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Free-Don.org. Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped, the real story of what's going on here in Washington, D.C., brilliant book, and former member of the United States House of Representatives and current reporter for the Talk Radio News Service, on the line with us. Hey, Bob, how are you?
Good. How are you, Tom?
They're very well, thank you. What's going on in the world? I understand. First of all, I understand that 10 million American patriots showed up on the Mall today to demand the resignation of the president and the vice president and all the Democratic leadership and the American Spring, the uprising. How'd that go?
Well, I got to tell you, I mean, I would say it was closer to 25 million.
Seriously?
No, I'm just kidding.
I heard it was about 25 people, actually.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah.
I was making a joke there.
Yeah. Okay.
When I first read they were going to get the, and then they were going to have the tribunal.
Oh, really?
Yes. Senator Cruz, they were nominating, I'm sure he really, honestly, he probably doesn't appreciate this. They were going to make him head of the quote, tribunal.
To try Obama for being a secret Muslim or something?
They were bipartisan. They were going to mix Boehner in there and everybody else.
Incredible.
But I don't know where these things come from. They were calling it the Patriot Spring, like the Arab Spring.
Yeah, it's the right wing fringe. It's the fringe of the right wing fringe.
Well, this is the fringe of the fringe. These are the ones that Ted Cruz calls wackos.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. This is the Cliven Bundy faction of the Republican Party.
And of course, it got all this media attention before they, 25 people got there. But where do they get this from? I just don't get it.
Yeah, I don't either. Because there were hundreds of people out in front of the FCC yesterday, and I didn't see much coverage about that.
No, that's true. Yes, with the net neutrality. And
yeah,
I did want to mention, the Republicans can snatch, a possible semi-victory with Congressman Gowdy, in the sense of a better type of, prosecutorial type of guy. But they can snatch it away and throw it away. Congressman Issa just can't help himself. Maybe people from the Democratic side ought to contribute to make sure he stays in.
Well, he's got enough money. He doesn't need contributions.
That's true. He's issued a subpoena for May 29th for Secretary of State Kerry. And this is, this is over Benghazi.
Right.
And, Secretary of State Kerry has already right away said, I'll come talk to Congressman Gowdy and a select committee. And now they seriously cannot stop Congressman Issa. And what he's doing, he's angry. It's his, quote, jurisdiction. This has been his, quote, baby. This and the IRS, and he's handled these in his mind correctly. So he's issued this, and this is really going to be quite ridiculous, frankly, to have a Secretary of State go to one place and then he goes to another.
Was Issa in favor of the creation of the Select Committee, or was he opposed to it?
Well, he's not going to. He feels, and I know this from contacts on the Hill. He was very angry. He wanted to head the thing up. He wanted it either to be in his committee,
just like he wanted to be governor of California.
So he's not going to say he's against investigating it, but this is his way of saying, hey, this is my jurisdiction. I'm going to do this regardless. This is not what they wanted done.
Remember when he wanted to be governor of California, he put $1 million into taking down Gray Davis and then discovered that Ken Lay had been secretly meeting with Arnold Schwarzenegger at the Beverly Hills Hotel and set Schwarzenegger up to run. And he literally, when he heard that, he was on camera and he broke down in tears. Remember that?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I tell people, I went directly to the Speaker's office to stop him from being on my committee.
Oh, really?
Oh,
when you were in Congress.
Did I tell you that?
No.
That's a little tidbit. I chaired House Administration, Speaker's appointment, only 9 committee members, 3 Ds and 6 Rs. And he came to me and he said, I want on your committee. And he had disrupted our entire operation of trying to bring the House up to speed technologically. He disrupted the entire thing constantly. And my staff came to me and they said, oh, my goodness, he wants on the committee. He'll destroy, the way the House is running. They literally said that.
Yeah.
And so I told the chief guy, Vandermeed, the speaker, and I talked to the speaker. And I said, if he goes on the committee, I seriously would think about stepping out of the Congress at that time.
Wow. I have heard that Darrell Issa doesn't play well with others. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Well, it was horrible. He disrupted our staff. I mean, look, people have opinions and such things, but he literally disrupted. He constantly would say, you people are destroying the way we're doing technology of the House. I know how to do it better than all of you. And it was constant. So we finally just shut the door on him.
Yeah.
We had to. We weren't going to get anywhere in, getting the House up to speed.
Amazing. It's I love these little stories, the things that I learned from you from when you were, a Republican in the House of Representatives. It was it's fascinating to talk to you, Bob. What else is going on in the world?
Well, the Republicans are filibustering tax breaks, which is quite a kind of a chuckle there.
Yeah.
And Senator Chuck Schumer said he's befuddled by the opposition by the Republicans. It's a pro-business package. But there were 2 amendments they wanted. One removed a tax break for the wind devices, which I don't understand why they had wanted to do that. There was no real explanation, except maybe it doesn't burn oil or something.
That's the explanation.
So Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, had said, if you vote for cloture, we will set up what's called a tree of amendments, but they wouldn't do that, so they're technically holding up the tax relief bill that was out there, so it's yet to be seen, how they'll end up with that. The Nigeria situation has become a little bit difficult. We've added our assistance to Nigeria, but internally, Nigeria is just such a trouble-plagued country, and as some experts in D.C. are saying and advising the White House, if Nigeria doesn't step up to the plate and have a plan, you know, how to go in, you can provide them all the information you want about where these girls are, but they're not going to be able to carry out any type of relief effort.
Yeah. Good luck. Jonathan is not a competent leader. It's not a competent country. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, the author of Sideswiped. If you have not bought this book and read it and discovered how Washington, D.C. works, you are in for a surprise. It's a treat. Bob, thanks for being with us.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
Good talking. We'll be back with more of Anything Goes Friday right after the news.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I was just looking at a short YouTube that's posted over on Democratic Underground of the American Spring March. That you know, the 20 million people who were going to show up on the mall, or 10 million, I guess it was. And it's like maybe 100. And there's this guy who comes up to the camera, and this is like, you know, they're documenting their own thing, right? They get a woman coming up who says, you know, when tyranny becomes the law, opposition to the law or breaking the law becomes a moral obligation or whatever, you know, kind of quoting the, and another one says the founders would be outraged. And then this guy comes forward. He goes, where are you at? We put out the call 3 months ago, 6 months ago. And we said we'd be here. We're here. Where are you? And he's like, talking to his brothers and sisters, you know, he's talking to his people. He's saying, come on, you crazed right winger Tea Partier people, why aren't you here with us? There's like 30 of us. I mean, you know. Anyway, it's kind of sad. Susan in Warren, Washington. Hey, Susan, what's up?
Yeah, not that this is the topic I was going to touch on, but hopefully Marie, and I think it was Ray from Roy, Washington. If they go to a site called Know the Cause, they'll probably find what they're looking for, because I believe that part of Ray's problems could be nutritional, having to do with fungus buildup from wheat.
Mm.
And she was looking for a Christian site, and it's quite knowledgeable because it's actually more like what's called neutropathic type situations of, but they also have like a faith-based.
Yeah. Okay.
The other part that I wanted to touch on is just that, and it's not just in the Seattle area or Washington State. It's throughout the entire nation. I mean, we are in the midst of the greatest depression already. And I don't know. I'm just trying to find a way to rethink, a way to try to stretch my dollar to trying to find something to rent, because I myself have been filling out various applications, and because of that, it's having a, just like when you fill out a credit application to getting a card, a way that I'm being looked over as a candidate to even renting an apartment or a studio or any of the above.
Yeah. Well, that was, that's the premise of my book, The Crash of 2016, is that we are still in the crash of 2008. It has not stopped. We have not recovered from it. It has merely been paused. You know, so that the stock market could run back up and the billionaires could make, you know, double and triple their money again. at the top. And,
well, that's
and
the point
and,
I was going to touch on right. is the people who are now financing what you can rent at affordable housing
right.
is none other than the bank. So what is their yep. thing to trying to make it affordable to someone who actually needs to have subsidies? And that's why the wait lists are anywhere from 6.5, 8 years to 10 years Whoa. To trying to find something.
Amazing. Well, it's not just the banks, Susan. There are private equity companies, you know, Mitt Romney kind of companies in this business, and there are hedge funds in this business. It's like
I know last night you had touched on the one holding company called Fever Press.
Yeah.
Before Mr.
That was a PR agency.
And then the other is the environmental is Longhorn Pipeline Environmental, which mm-hmm. when I looked into it, it would be if I had taken a job using my master's degree and started soliciting clients, there was a conflict of interest.
Yeah, there were lots of them, and these companies that put this stuff together for the State Department and the ones that are out doing the PR. I mean, the whole thing around the Keystone XL pipeline is so corrupt. It is just so wrong.
And fracking.
And fracking. No doubt about it. Susan, I got to move along, but thank you for your call and thanks for your comments. I don't know what to say other than I wish you the very best. Jared in Burlington, Vermont, 1938 hurricane.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about the 38 hurricane, but I'd also like to talk about something else very briefly. 38 hurricane bounded across Cuba, swept up the East Coast, just off the coast, went straight over Long Island, hit Providence, which went underwater, and then went up the Connecticut Valley, hopped over to Lake Rivasauke, and you know, just took out great hunks of that.
Hmm.
Sandy, we know about. It also hopped over Cuba up the East Coast, but it took a sharp left. Let's just suppose that there's a third hurricane. It goes over Cuba, up the East Coast, takes a sharp left, but a little earlier, and it takes out Newport News, then goes up the Chesapeake Bay, up to Baltimore, taking out Annapolis on the way. But before it goes up to Baltimore, it splits and goes up the Potomac River, takes out the airport at Washington, floods much of the White House, maybe even takes out your houseboat. I don't have a solution for that, but it's a frightening possibility, maybe even a frightening reality.
Well, living.
I don't want to talk.
No, I'm with you, and we're Louise and I are very clear. We've got a little waterproof. It's called a waterproof safe, but it's like a suitcase basically that we keep all of the things in that we, you know, if the boat goes down, we don't want to lose. And because when Hurricane Sandy came through, I mean, you know, living in a boat in a marina is not, it's almost identical to living in a trailer in a trailer park. And, you know, if the hurricane comes through, everything gets busted up and turns into splinters and you got nothing left and everything you have is ruined. And it really puts you in touch with, you know, how fragile we all are and how powerful nature is.
The other thing I'd like to touch on, if I may, earlier we talked, I mean, it was some months ago, we talked about the three hot areas, Eastern Europe,
China, Japan, Taiwan, Vietnam.
Right.
Southeast Asia.
Japan is Prime Minister
Abe
is trying to rewrite the treaty. We had a series of treaties in the 50s with Japan, with South Korea, with the Philippines, with Taiwan, and now with Vietnam. And the problem is,
I don't think we have a treaty agreement with Vietnam right now. I'm quite sure of that. I read an article in the Financial Times a couple of days ago about could the Vietnam-China conflict spread to an American-China conflict, and it said that it couldn't because the United States has no mutual defense treaty with Vietnam. We have some bilateral trade agreements, but that's it.
So scratch that one and keep the other four or five.
Yeah.
But the problem is that
if South Korea and Japan go at it, we're going to get sucked into it. If Vietnam and Formosa go at it, we're going to get sucked into it.
Right.
And the, kind of the unintended consequences. Think back to the Falkland Islands. Had Britain landed in Argentina, then under the Rio Treaty, we would be forced to send troops to Argentina to defend them against the British. I mean,
yeah.
It's unreal. I guess my question is there any possibility to rethink the obligations that were set forth in the 20th century?
Right. To avoid setting up another World War I scenario.
Another 1914.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The only way to do that, treaties have to be approved by the Senate, and they have to be proposed typically by the president. And so the only way to do that would be for the president and the Senate to work together and make these kind of things happen. And I don't think that anybody has the political, in this administration or in this Senate, the political sophistication or the foresight to do it, frankly. You're dealing with much smaller things.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sorry to say that, Jared, but I think that's where it's going. We'll be back. Welcome back. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, thanks for listening to KBCS. What's up?
Hey, Tom. A lot of science today.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to mention, for the one caller, I was talking about magnetism. And the thing about magnetism is it's due to electrons on both north and south ends. It's, magnetism is electrons have a spin,
mm-hmm.
Clockwise or counterclockwise, depending on how you want to look at it. And the south is one way, clockwise, say, and the north is spin, the electrons are spinning the other way, and they're just separated by spin. So all molecules or all atoms have electrons that are spinning both ways. It's just when you are able to separate them, that's how you get magnetism. So you couldn't really generate, yeah. So his idea of generating a current through the magnet wouldn't really.
Yeah.
That would just be putting the electrons back into mixed up.
Back magnet. Into random random order, and then you lose your magnetic
yeah.
charge. Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. But I was thinking about, you know, the climate change thing, and what a lack of resourceful will this country seems to have. You know, when the climate change report came out from the White House last week, it was just pilloried by the right wing and just junk, unsubstantiated junk science. And I started thinking, look at the science they want us to really embrace, intelligent design. I was like, oh, that's got lots of support, you know, lots of evidential support for it. I think these guys are nuts, you know, and their whole attitude seems to be, you know, we don't need any new laws of gravity. Let's just enforce the ones we have.
Right.
That's their attitude towards science.
Right.
But when it comes to renewable sources of energy, you know, when we've talked about this before, when you burn fossil fuels, so much of what we use in our cars, for instance, it's wasted. 95% of the energy that's liberated to make your car run is wasted in heat.
Yeah.
So that means that all of this, what's causing global warming, was we have too much heat scattered all over the place. So even the technology that will help us harness renewable energy, such as solar, could also help us collect the heat. It's the heat that's all over the place. All the heat that's causing global warming just represents work that wasn't done. It was energy that was liberated, but the work wasn't done.
It's the waste byproduct of burning fossil fuels or fissioning radioactive isotopes.
Right, but the heat part we can still use. The heat is still out there. The heat is energy.
Yeah.
It didn't go away.
Yeah.
So we should be able to collect it all back. It's just in random space. It's not usable.
Yeah.
Yet what we'd like to do is when we find tar sands oil in Canada, look at all the energy we're willing to. I mean, I just wonder if this energy equation, because you're talking about you don't get enough energy when you make an electromagnet and spin it around to make a generator.
Right.
I just wonder what the heat equation is, or the energy equation is, when you pump a bunch of tar sands oil all the way from Canada down to the Gulf of Mexico, and then go through all the chemical separation that's going to be needed to get all the junk out of it.
I would
and
be
then refine it into glassine if you end up with any positive energy.
I would be surprised if it was above 15 or 20%. But see, they're talking about hundreds of millions of gallons a day or barrels a day, and so, you know, that's billions a year. And so, you know, they're going to make money on it. I mean, even at a 15% efficiency. But yeah, I'm with you, Paul. I think it's another reason why it's such a bad idea. And it doesn't include things like, you know, the maintenance and what do you do when it spills and the commons and are they going to really clean it up with diapers and all that other stuff. Paul, thanks for the call. Always nice to hear from you. We'll be back 20 minutes past the hour. With you and Kiss Kid in Yucca Valley, California. You are watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. You are on the air, sir.
Hi, Dr. Tom. You had a little rumble the other evening with Horace, and you were talking about the VA funding, and you only went back through the Obama administration,
right.
And they jumped you about, you know, let's go back further, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Anyhow, has anybody done that or in your great audience? And
well,
the
Horace did it himself. What, you know, the Republicans have explicitly filibustered legislation that would help the VA or veterans either 9, 10, 11, 12 times, something like that. I mean, we had the list.
Yes.
We showed it on TV. Since Obama came into office, and it's because it's Obama in office. I mean, their strategy, and I've said this several times, and I think it's being proven, in a big way, their strategy is cause pain to as many people as possible, and those people will blame that pain on the guy in the White House and his party, and that's the entire Republican 2014 strategy, probably the 2016 strategy. So then Horace said, but wait a minute, during the Bush administration, Democrats filibustered Republican efforts to expand the VA. And I was like, name one. And Kevin was unable to name one. It turned out Horace came in and he said it was the continuing resolutions. And in other words, let's continue funding government with a continuing resolution that encompasses hundreds of different things, including the VA. And there was opposition from the Democrats on some of those CRs. And I think appropriately so. It wasn't partisan opposition. It was this is bad legislation opposition, and it had nothing to do with the veterans part of it. So to the best of my knowledge, there's been no attempt, no effort, and no Republican has presented any to me of any, you know, of any specific veterans associated legislation. And I was naming specific pieces of legislation that had the word veterans in them that Republicans
Absolutely.
Have filibustered since 2009. Nothing like that happened before President Obama became president.
And one last thing. You were talking to Mike Papantonio, and he was talking about that dark money, whatever you want to call it, money, is coming into a judicial elections. And something I was out of, you know, I was under the weather the last few days. But after 30 days, they have to disclose their owners. Is that how I understood that?
That's my understanding, although it varies from state to state. But what Pap was pointing out is that the top law enforcement official in the state, in every state, is a fellow whose title is, or a woman whose title is Attorney General. And that the way Pap was one of the main litigants in that tobacco settlement back a decade and a half, 2 decades ago. It's how he kind of made his chops. And the way that they were successful in doing that was you had the private sector lawyers representing individuals who had been harmed, joining with the attorney generals of a whole bunch of states, 20 some odd states, who said not only have these individuals been harmed, but our Medicaid system has been harmed because we had to pay for their health care. And we would like, you know, to recover those costs. And ultimately, the tobacco companies lost billions on that thing. And so looking at this now, the Chamber of Commerce is now starting to throw money into these AG races because they don't want the top cop to be somebody who might, you know, they do. Let me rephrase that. they do want the top cop, the attorney general, in each individual state to be somebody who is totally corporate friendly and will never again join something like that class action lawsuit against the tobacco company companies.
And one last thing.
Yeah.
There was nothing. I'm a nut, but I watch the three evening newses.
Mm-hmm. You mean ABC, CBS, NBC?
Yes.
Wow, I'm impressed.
And there was nothing on the internet vote.
Nothing?
Not a thing.
Now, I expect that from NBC. They're owned by Comcast, you know, but, and, well, see, ABC is Disney. I don't know that it's not anymore. Say what? Yeah, ABC is Disney. CBS is Viacom. Viacom's got internet, but I don't think they're big like Comcast. I'm surprised all three networks ignored it. I'm sorry to hear that. Go ahead.
I could be wrong. I have been a little bit foggy. Oh, I took a drive to the hottest place in the United States today, Palm Springs, 105 degrees, same temperature as Death Valley.
Whoa.
Tom, have a great weekend coming up. And
thanks for everything
you do.
Thank you, kid. Wow, that's amazing. We got good friends who live in Palm Springs. Sean in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Sean, how are you doing?
Howdy, Tom. How's it going?
Fine, thank you. What's up?
Hey, a couple of things. I wanted to tell Bruce in Richmond, there's an organization in Indiana called SOCOA, and that's the Central Indiana Council on Aging, and they help people with disabilities.
Wait a minute, Central Indiana Council on Aging, did you say?
Yeah, the Central Indiana Council on Aging.
Okay, and they help people with disabilities. Okay.
And they should be with food stamps and whatever else you need help with.
Okay, great.
And another thing, too, Tom, I was a medical marijuana activist in the 90s, and I went all over the Midwest. You know, this was back when it was barely a blip on the media map.
Right.
And, you know, I think that you should get Steve Hager, the editor, on the show. He's just like one of the greatest Americans.
Steve Hager is the editor of what?
He's the editor of High Times Magazine.
Oh, High Times Magazine. Yeah. Okay. Thanks for the suggestion, Sean. I appreciate it. And always nice to hear from you. I hope things are going well for you. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Anything Goes Friday show. And, boy, we've got a whole bunch of topics here. Questions about the American Revolution, conversion kits to turn cars into electric vehicles, insurance companies causing climate change, chemtrails, organic batteries, democracy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Wealth inequality, drug testing politicians. Oh, that's an interesting one. We'll be picking up your calls right after. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And oops, there's a window sitting on top of my call screening software. Okay, here we go. Matt in Amherst, Mass. Hey, Matt. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I actually, quick question that your pharma couldn't answer. I came in the program a little late, and I heard something about magnetic motors, and I was wondering what you were saying about them. Their viability, because I'm actually in the process of building one. So,
well, what I was, motors and generators are basically the same thing. It's just with a motor, if you run electrons through a coil in the presence of magnets, they will spin the magnets and rotate the armature and thus, you know, move something.
And
with a generator, if you spin a magnet in the presence of coils of wire, lots and lots of wire, it'll induce an electrical current in that wire and produce electricity. So the point that I was making was that the amount of energy, say you've got a generator and you're cranking that generator and you're producing electricity out of it, and you produce 100 watts of electricity out of the generator. Wattage is amperage times voltage, so you know, it's just a measurement of total power. Say it's 100 watts. The amount of energy you're going to have to exert cranking that magnet generator to spin that magnet around inside that wire is greater than 100 watts. You can't have an efficiency that's greater than 100%. If you did, you would have a perpetual motion machine. You would have, you know, you'd be violating Newton's first law of physics. And
I understand that.
So that was my point.
What do you know about like pulse motors, where you set up the configuration basically in a evenly spaced in a circle? You know, the bigger the magnet, obviously, the better. You wind the coil in the center. It's, a pulse box motor. They've been, running for the last couple of years, upwards of 10,000 watts of electricity, and upwards of, high amperage, being able to run entire houses. And all it requires, it doesn't require a generator or anything like that. It does require a starting mechanism, which is more or less a rotational force to get the motor going. But that rotational force can be as simple as a hand crank to get this motor running, and it slowly starts and slowly picks up speed as the magnet roll on this coil and basically turn into, I can't call it a perpetual machine because you actually exert energy into it in order for it to
you may have a situation. First of all, the pulse system, what you're describing is how maglev systems work for the the levitational trains in Germany and or in Japan and China. But it's still not 100%. I mean, if you got to 90, 91, 92, 95, 99%, it'd be really, really cool. There have been dramatic improvements in the efficiency of both motors and generators in the last 150 years. But it's still not 100%. And so,
of course, you're not going to get 100% based on exactly what you said with Newton. But you are.
Well, also you have you also not only can't you get to 100% because you can't, because there are losses in the wire. There's resistive losses in the wire. There are mechanical losses, kinetic losses in the spinning of the magnets. There are losses throughout the system, and you have to add those losses up and subtract that from your total percentage of efficiency.
I understand what you're saying completely. I'm just saying that it is way more efficient, let's say, that for a person's own house to generate electricity, they install, say, if someone would create, a model that could be a scale on a much bigger, on a wider volume, that would be much better in
But what's going to produce the energy that's going to spin that thing? I mean, it's like if you put solar panels on the roof, you take the electricity off the solar panels and spin them, then you're simply introducing, it seems to me, you're introducing to the system another loss, because if it's less than 100% efficient, why have it in series with anything?
You're always going to have a loss in terms of energy, because you can never obviously get to 100%. But with let's say oil, I don't know exactly what it is, but it would be somewhere maybe around 30 or 40%. But with something like this, where these pulse motor machines, not big either, they're probably about 2 or 3 times the size of like a 5,000 watt generator,
right.
And you're going to have a little bit of electrical know-how to be able to operate it, but not really. Once it's all assembled, it's pretty go-go. It's simple as a hand.
I'm telling you, Matt, if there was such a thing that you could power your house with a hand crank, a periodic hand crank, there would be so much money to be made in that, and they would be so widely distributed. And it's just, a hand crank, you're not, if you need 1,000 watts to power your house, and you're going to try and put 1,000 watts of kinetic energy, of muscle energy, into cranking a generator, you're talking about, running on a treadmill, you're producing 2 or 3 watts of power per every 10 or 15 minutes, or something. It's some very, very low, they've got treadmills now that'll actually give you output in terms of wattage. You can tell how many calories you've burned or the equivalent of how many watts you produced. and it's really very low. It's our muscles are not efficient in terms of producing those kind of levels of energy. But you know, feel free to post. If you've got links to something about this, I'd love to see it. Go over to our daily blog on TomHartmann.com on the homepage and post links to it. I read that. I'd love to check it out. Matt, I got to move along. Let some more people in here and, you know, participate in the conversation. Libby in with Washington moved to amend WAMEND.org. Libby, you are looking for volunteers to pass out petitions and people to sign petitions to put on the Washington state ballot ballot initiative to say money is not speech, and corporations are not people. Excuse me. Go for
right,
it.
Right, and all contributions must be regulated and disclosed.
There
that's
you,
right.
Well, yeah. Well, that could be legislation right. That follows up in the tail end of that.
Right. We want to see an amendment to the Constitution, number 28. We want to help states everywhere do that. So we're getting signatures and we're getting support. We even have a new program out called Politicians for Democracy who are carrying the petition.
That's great. That's
and
great.
A lot of them are feeling very passionate about this issue because they don't like having to fundraise.
And the website is WAMEND.org, as in Washington Amend. You know, Washington State, W Amend or WAMEND, WAMEND.org. Libby, thanks for calling and reminding everybody about it. Great to hear from you. Tom in Holyoke, Colorado. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I would like to have a kit that would take the radiator and the internal combustion motor out of your car, and then you could slide an electric motor right in and with an adapter hook up to the transmission, either front axle or rear axle. And without the radiator and the oil and everything, it would take a normal car and make it electric.
I've seen people do that. I've seen articles in Popular Mechanics or whatever the magazine is. I mean, you know, this is like a decade ago of people basically electrifying usually fairly lightweight cars, Volkswagen Beetles or an old Mustang or something like that, Ford Mustang. I don't know of any commercially available ones, but, you know, there Home Power magazine, which I subscribed to for years. I still get their email. We had to stop all our magazine subscriptions because of where we live. Home Power magazine, they've got a great website, and you may find stuff like that and maybe some of the automotive magazines. I don't know if anybody's doing it commercially, but you should be able to track it down. Great idea. Tom, thanks for the call. Jake in Chicago. Hey, Jake, what's up?
Hi, Tom. The other day you were speaking to someone, and they mentioned that one of the incentives for getting something done about climate change was going to be the insurance companies basically saying we can't insure this stuff anymore. Earlier this week, the Chicago Tribune had an article, which I emailed an PDF of it to you, that said that Farmers Insurance was suing a number of municipalities here in Illinois to recoup basically the money paid out on claims for the flooding of 2013, stating that the municipalities were not doing enough to offset the effects of flooding and dams and diversions and sandbags and stuff like that. The problem is that the people that will pay for any settlement will be the taxpayers, and they are made up of the people who paid the insurance premiums.
Yeah, you're right. And the other game that the insurance companies play is that they rewrite the policies every single year, and they've always done this. And that's why they really don't care that much about climate change. They just Jake, thanks for the call. Swiss Re is on the record as saying this is a big problem. They're the backstop for the insurance companies. But basically, the entire insurance industry, all they do is either jack up the premiums as the risk goes up, or they include the exclusions. They increase the exclusions. So it's an old game. We'll do that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Visit TomHartmann.com for audio and video archives.
The net of that is that the insurance industry will openly acknowledge climate change and its problems, but they're never going to be our allies. They're always going to figure out a way to make money on this. Welcome back. Greg in Devil's Lake, North Dakota. Hey, Greg, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the TV satellite system. What's up?
Can you give me a quick synopsis of the 40-hour work week?
the history of the 40-hour work week?
Well, in the mid to late 19th century, you had a 60-hour work week, which was average. And then through the progressive era, the early 1900s, there were battles for the 50-hour work week. That was the rallying cry in 1916. And Teddy Roosevelt was talking about that in 1912 when he was running on the Bull Moose Party. And then the 40-hour work week came along, as I recall, with the FDR's New Deal and became standard after World War II. That's my thumbnail overview of it, and it may or may not be specifically accurate. I don't have specific dates and things, but that's my understanding.
That's okay. I accept it, sir. But I'm wondering, is it a presidential?
No.
Does it have to be a presidential declaration or
no.
Constitution?
No, neither. These all came about as the consequence of legislation, as Congress passing laws, and the laws had to do with when you had to start paying overtime, and how many hours you could, basically require somebody to work, and beyond that you can't require them to work anymore, and it went from basically unregulated, where the standard was 60 hours, to semi-regulated, where the standard was 50 hours, to highly regulated, where the standard was 40 hours. And now in the last 30 years, it's become, once again, relatively deregulated, and large portions of our workforce work a lot more than 40 hours a week.
Though, couldn't it?
Pardon?
It could be done by presidential edict?
No, the president does not have that kind of authority.
Oh, our current president could not. Okay, see, I was going to suggest, because, okay, it's legislative, what I think what we ought to do against corporations who are, that fellow called you from Illinois, that Bruce, and he went on his rant about being disabled and they can't even qualify for this food stamps.
Right.
And look, it's disgraceful. Corporations like Walmart and Big Eddie, McDonald's, and all them others, they're paying their employees slave wages, and they won't give them benefits,
right,
like medical. And so they got to go on food stamps and Obamacare.
Yeah. No, this is their business model, Greg. They pay just enough that people, or just enough, they keep their pay just like, $10 a year or $100 a year below what would disqualify people for those benefits. So the majority of their employees will always qualify for food stamps and housing assistance and child care assistance and things like that. And they never let their pay go above that point, because then those people wouldn't qualify for those benefits, and we would not be subsidizing the fast food industry and Walmart and whatnot. And it's the business model. It's just, frankly, nakedly their business model. And that's why, and thanks for the call, Greg, that's why Obama wants to take the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. Because $10.10 an hour is the point at which, in most states, people no longer qualify for those benefits. And it will help the states out tremendously, and it'll shift the burden back to the corporations, who are actually the employers. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at the various companies that syndicate this program, Westwood One, at part of Cumulus, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, CRN, the Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, and all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, the others around the country, to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio at netrootsradio.com, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and to the folks in our chat room, to Alan Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Nay, everyone at Talk Radio News Service, Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. It is much appreciated. Jerry in Long Island, New York, listening on WBAI. Hey, Jerry, how you doing?
Yeah, okay, how you doing? Yeah, I'd like to go back to this issue, a question you raised about 2 weeks ago, oddly enough, instead of something currently in the news. And the question is America a democracy anymore? And I would say no, from my perspective. Instead, we're gradually becoming more and more of a combination, corporatocracy and plutocracy, that seems to be run by, of, and for both big, powerful, wealthy corporations and also big, powerful, wealthy individuals. And so increasingly, more and more what I see is that I see our nation's politicians, unfortunately from both major political parties, I'm sad to say, in my opinion, they seem to subscribe to the faulty mindset that what's ever good for either the corporation or what's ever good for the wealthy individual is automatically good for all of America. And so even in a supposedly progressive state like mine, like New York, where we have a supposedly Democratic governor, he opposes raising taxes even a little bit on anybody, including millionaires and billionaires. And meanwhile, I constantly
see Cuomo's no progressive, Jerry. Cuomo's
well,
no.
Not really. No. Well, let me explain why.
He's barely a Democrat.
Well, here's the thing. He supported privatization of Medicaid, and he's pushing that, where people are being pushed into private managed care companies. He supports the charter school industry, and he's reprivatized the Long Island's only monopolistic electric company, LIPA, which was quasi-governmental. He made it put it in private hands. And I see these ads promoting the fact that in New York State, now you have for corporations who do nothing more than relocate here in certain places, they get completely
10 years of no taxes.
Status for 10 years, yeah.
Yeah, but if I were to call them up and say, hey, I'll move my show to New York, you're gonna give me no taxes for 10 years, they'd laugh at me. I mean, this is all for the big boys and. Yeah, but more to your point, Jerry, is America a democratic republic? And I think we need to use both words. We never have been, and we aren't now. We have always been it's always been aspirational rather than full. And we've gone in and out of these phases where we become more of a democratic republic and less of a democratic republic. We were much more of a democratic republic, arguably, in the early days, except for the fact that women couldn't vote and people of color couldn't vote. So how can you call us a democratic republic even at all? You know, so now the franchise is dramatically extended, but our legislature has been totally corrupted as a result of these Supreme Court decisions. So, you know, what we need to do is work toward that aspiration that was identified in the early language, but was not acted out until the 19th Amendment and Brown v. Board and the Civil Rights Acts and whatnot, and now we've got to have our own progressive revolution again. It's time for another Teddy Roosevelt, another Tillman Act, another get the corporations, get the money out of politics, and then we can become a democratic republic again. You're right, Jerry. Thank you for the call, Greg in Fairport, New York, listening on Progressive Voices and TuneIn.
Hey, hi, Greg. Tom. How are you?
Good. What's up?
Hey, I got a question about. I can't figure this out. If a good part of our wealth is being sequestered by billionaires and the megacorps and whatnot, they've got it socked away overseas. What happens to that money? How do we get it back?
We don't. Depending on whose numbers you're looking at in corporate wealth, it's tens of trillions. Yeah, it's tens of trillions. And in individual wealth, it's over a trillion. That is, whoops, I did it again. I touched the button and I dumped the caller and put another caller on. I'm sorry. We don't get it. We would have to pass legislation to change our tax code so that money overseas could be grabbed. And right now, as long as the Republicans control the House and have filibuster power in the Senate, it ain't going to happen. The rich people are going to stay mind-bogglingly rich. Morris in Long Beach, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Morris, what's up?
Love you, Professor. Listen, $15 an hour. That is a win-win situation for everybody.
It is.
It also improves the quality of life, obviously, for the employees. Check this out. Let me tell you what it does for the federal government. They no longer have to pay all that money to subsidize people for health and housing and whatnot.
Yep.
States have a new revenue now, the state sales tax, that would be an increase there. Commercial businesses now have more activity. I mean, it's just too much of a win-win situation to ignore. It's funny that the Republicans always want that money to be replaced when we're talking about unemployment benefits being extended. But tax cuts, we don't have to find the money to replace that. And they didn't ask for any replacement of the money when we were thinking about going to war with Syria. It seems if we talked about feeding somebody or housing somebody or trying to educate somebody, a cynical spirit comes in, and I don't seem to understand it. But that $15 an hour, that's the ticket, because folks are going to spend that money. It's going to circulate. It's not going to collect dust.
Morris, you're absolutely right. What you are describing is classical economics. It's Adam Smith economics. It is demand, which is wages. My wage is your job. Demand is what drives all economies, and demand is caused by paychecks at the bottom 90%. Morris, thank you for the call. Brilliant. Thanks for listening to KPFK. Coming up on Monday, in spite of the 60th anniversary of Brown v. Board, segregation is alive and well in America in the form of school choice and the privatization movement. It wants to make a quality education available only to the wealthiest of Americans. I'll challenge pro-choice supporter Neil McCluskey of the Cato Institute. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It starts with you. Get out there, get active, and occupy something, starting with your child's education. I'll see you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.